Everybody can hear me at the back? Yes. Can you see on the slides? Okay, excellent. Right. My name is Roloff Temming. I'm from a company called SensePost. If you've been here for a while and you attended the training, you probably know us. We're doing a talk today on when the tables turn. I think it's an interesting concept. I think it's a bit of a controversial concept. You decide. So what we're going to go through today is basically thinking about the concept, trying to understand how the concept works. After that, we're going to do an introduction. We look at types of defensive technology, raising the bar on assessments, typical assessment methodology, and really after that, we're going to look at all different examples and see how we can do this. Okay, so if you didn't know that, we're from South Africa, and there's a lot of crime in South Africa. So a friend of mine, actually two blocks away from my house, there's this big sign that says hijacking hotspot. That's not anything to do with wireless. That's basically where they hijack you. Okay, so you have to drive through there real quick. It's the truth, I can show you a photograph. Now, a friend of mine actually had his car broken into there. He wasn't hijacked, but his window was smashed, and someone took some stuff, his cell phone and his wallet and his stuff, out of his car, dragged it out of his car, and ran away into the bushes. We got lots of bushes in South Africa as well. Afterwards, I spoke to him, and he said to me, you know, the thing that he really actually wanted to do was to put a small piece of C4 explosive in his wallet with a remote detonator so that when someone steals it, he can see there they go into the bushes and goes, you know. The second example I want to give you is everybody in South Africa have electric fencing around their perimeters, around their walls. I had a motorbike and a scrambler. I don't know if you call it a scrambler in America. And they actually stole this motorbike by taking it and pulling it up and taking it over the wall and dropping it at the other side on a Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. So that's a bit hectic. So now I've got these electric fencing around the house, and all of a sudden things are a little bit better. So what we see is that if we want to, this talk is really about attacking attackers, but attacking them in a clever way, right? Attacking them when you are sure that they are attacking you, right? So the electric fencing around my house will not shock someone unless they want to break into the house. You see this in the insect world, in the animal world as well. With, for instance, you get these bugs that are really acidy, and so predators don't want to eat them because they really taste bad. You also see it with, for instance, the electric eel. The electric eel is minding its own business, but if you start touching it, then it's going to shock you, right? And taking it even more into a situation where we can understand is in the spy world, you have a concept of disinformation. So that's feeding information that we know is wrong. So let's just look at what's happening in the assessment, and I put assessment in inverted commas. That could be also the kind of hacking space today. We know that technology is getting smarter and smarter, and that people are getting lazier and lazier. And in the good old days, we used to say that a good hacker was someone that's technically clever and that is technically competent and has innovative thinking. But these days, we kind of measure the success or the we measure the skill of a hacker by the size of his or her toolbox, right? So the more tools we have, the more powerful we are. And there's a perception, especially by the press, that says Hackers are clever and administrators are dumb. Okay? So you read in the paper about someone that broke into a network, but you don't read about the sysadmin that for the other 364 days is securing that network and keeping it safe, right? But what we find is that in many cases, the mechanic's car is broken. So the attacker's network is not secure, and the attacker doesn't bother running the latest service patches, and the attacker doesn't look at the tools that he or her is running to actually do assessments. And this is what, in this talk, what we're going to focus on. We're going to look at how we can look at ways to attack the tools and the methods that attackers will be using on your network. And doing it clever so that, I'm going to show this in the next slide. If we look at the analogy between the current types of defensive technology and the situations that I described before, you could have the following. In the case of the robbery, a firewall would be like armor-plated windows on your car, right? So it's preventing the attacker from actually getting into the car. Okay? IDS would be like the South African police. A lot of the times you would report a crime to the police and they only act a few weeks later, right? So in IDS we see that as well. A lot of the times we see a log. When we see that thing in the log 2 days later, it's actually already happened, right? IPS, which is intrusion protection system, could be like driving away. Like, say, I don't want to be here, let's just drive away. And then we get people that says, well, when we see someone attacking us in our log files, we're actually going to attack back to that IP address. And that is very dangerous to do, right? Because we all know that you can spoof IP addresses, you can put decoys in scans, that kind of thing. And in our analogy, we say, this is like carrying a gun in your car. And when someone walks up to your car, you go, and you blast them, right? And that might be just someone that is trying to sell you something or asking to wash your windows. In the fence analogy, I'm not going to go into it too much. Firewalls we see as the walls around the perimeter, the actual walls around the house. The IDS is again like the police. The IPS is like an armed response. And a backhack would be a very trigger-happy wife that's sitting there with a shotgun. And when you get back 3 o'clock in the morning and you tap on the window because you don't have your keys anymore, you get it, right? So what we're trying to do in this talk, ideas that we want to give in this talk, is really raising the cost, in inverted commas, of an assessment, in inverted commas, okay? Which makes it difficult, we make it difficult for a person, or not a person actually, for a process to basically do a hack on your system, or to try to probe your system. We make it difficult for them to do. And in this case, what we're doing is we're attacking the technology, right? We're not attacking the people, because if you have some person at the back end of a scanner, a person is more intelligent than a tool, right? So keep this in mind throughout the talk, that we're attacking technology and we're attacking automation, right? We're attacking automation that says, you can't do this quickly anymore, right? You can't simply run a process and quickly get results. You have to do it manually. And if we attack automation, it means that someone might rather want to attack the next target and not you, because it's costing them too much to attack you. It could be costing them in time, in resources. It could be costing them in a level of feeling comfortable with what they're doing. Right? You understand what I'm saying? Not cost in terms of real money. We used to say, make sure that when you attack something, you're not sitting on a honeypot and that someone is monitoring everything that you're doing. What we want to move to is a situation that says, before you attack someone, make sure that your network is secure. Make sure that your tools that you're using are safe from attack. And make sure that you have all the service packs installed. So we want to create a little bit of paranoia on the side of the attacker. And it used to be always the other side, the other way around. That's why we call the talk "When the Tables Turn." Right? We used to measure our clients not in the same way or our targets, not in the same way as we measure ourselves. We used to tell our clients, you have to install these service packs, you need to do this, you must have segmentation on your network, all of these wonderful things. But when it comes to us, we don't kind of actively do that kind of thing, correct? Okay, so what we're going to look at is we're going to look through our methodology that we use, and if you were in our classes, you would know this methodology. We're going to look at our methodology of how we do assessment and look at every step along the way to try to figure out how we can do nasty things to the attacker. And typically, our assessment would say we do a footprint, we start with vitality, finding out which machines are alive. We do network level visibility, which is basically a fancy word for report scan. We do vulnerability discovery, vulnerability exploitation. And then there's a section that kind of don't fit in there because it's totally different, which is web application assessments. Okay? And I'm going to look at all these levels to see what we can do to raise the cost of an assessment. Okay? So, if we look at attacks, I'm going to classify it in four different types of attacks. That's the first one is avoiding or stopping the attack. That's kind of the technology that we have today. We're going to look at creating noise or confusion in the output of the tool. If you move a level beyond that, you look at stopping the tool. So making the attack actually stop, so that the attack don't happen anymore, or breaking the tool. And if we go more extreme, we could say, let's now attack back on the attacker's network, or the attacker's host, or the attacker's tool. Right? That's a bit harsh, but we'll see how we can do that. And these things we want to approach on three different levels. Right? We want to approach it on a network level, on a network application level, and on an application level. And I'm going to go through all of these and see how we can attack those, how we can attack on that specific level. Now, again, this is also something we teach with people, is think outside of the box, right? We control everything that's coming back to the attacker, okay? Every little piece of data that comes back into a scanner or that comes back into exploit is under our control, right? And we can take it on different levels. We can look at the packet itself and all the features of the packet. So the flags, the sequence numbers, all of that, those are under our control. We can look, if we look at a level up from that, we can look at DNS entries, forward entries, reverse entries. Those are also under our control. We can look at the banners coming back into scanners. We can look at error codes, messages, anything that passes up and down, up to the point where we are on application level, where the whole web page that we're passing back to the attacker is under our control. And the data that we pass back is used on different levels, right? Within the scanner, when the scanner actually, or the exploit actually reads that data off the network, that's where it's using that data. Where the scanner stores the data, so typically in databases or in files, that kind of thing, and when the scanner renders the data, so when it displays it back in some form to the attacker. We can attack it on those levels. Right, so what we're going to do now is we're going to look at, before I go into this, I put this slide in this morning because I was thinking about it. Now, legally, I don't know which of these things are acceptable to do back to an attacker. And to be frank, I'm not a legal person, so I wouldn't know, you know, if it's okay to do some of these things. So before you go out and implement some of the ideas that we have here, I would think that it would be wise to speak to someone in terms of how legal it would be to attack other networks through, or to attack your attackers. You will always know that they are attacking you. The idea is always that you know that they are attacking you. For instance, in the case with my friend that got hijacked or that got robbed, he knows that someone was attacking him, right? And the second thing I want to quickly do a disclaimer on is that technically these things that we want to show you is not, how can I say, industrial strength, right? So it's more concepts that we want you to take home and think about and see how you can implement it in your network. There's no, we don't release a tool here that says, use this thing, run it on your network, and it, you know, and we'll do a reverse attack. Right. Okay, so with that in mind, keep that in mind everywhere that you go within the examples that I'm giving. The other thing I also just want to say is that some of these things that we talk about here would typically not be feasible in your network for various kind of reasons. You might not want to implement this because of policy, but it could also be simply of technical reasons. Okay, so let's look at the different levels. We're going to go through all the different kind of steps that we go in assessment and see how we can attack it. So if you look at footprinting, how can you avoid someone footprinting you? There's actually clever ways that you can do this. You can basically hide all your DNS information so that people can't really get an idea of where your network is located. Okay, we can have a website that's totally hosted off-site. We can do some interesting tricks in DNS with your MX records so that no one really sees the MX record that's where you're receiving your mail. And the rest of the stuff we can simply ignore, especially when we're a corporation that don't deal with services on the internet, like online services, that kind of thing. In that case, we can really make it very, very difficult for an attacker to find out where your network is. Okay, if we want to create noise in a system, in terms of DNS, one of the things that we have done is we allow our zones to be transferred. Okay, we allow a zone transfer, and we know that we're allowing a zone transfer. But our zone consists of about 250,000 entries, which are random names, right? Random names that point to IP addresses of our choice. Okay, so at the moment the IP addresses are pointing anywhere within the world, totally random. But we could have also said that we put in all those kind of entries to point to a network that we know that when someone attacks that network, they're gonna be slapped on the hand, wrist. Okay, so for instance. So for instance, we can point all of those IP addresses back to the FBI. Now, if you simply blindly go do a zone transfer, get all the IP addresses and start attacking them, you'd be attacking 90% of your targets would be sitting at a place where you don't want to attack, right? Okay, I'm going to show you how that works. We can look at stopping DNS entries from being read or be completed. Right? So if we have a zone, if we have a name server that simply keeps on spinning back entries, if you do a zone transfer and never ever ends, if we have a tool that simply reads that zone, it's going to read that zone forever, right? The zone will never finish. And in terms of killing stuff, what we can do is, in forward entries, right? A forward entry is a name that points to an IP address. We can't really play with that a lot because IP addresses are numbers and dots. But when you do reverse entries, you now have the ability to basically insert any kind of character in your reverse name. If the name server that you build has that capability. Now normally, bind and those things don't allow you to do this. But if we build our own name server, right, we can put all sorts of interesting things in the reverse zone, such as backtick, pipe and a command, right? Or some HTML. And we never know how this will be interpreted by whatever you're using to get those entries back. Okay? So it could be that if we put in their backtick rm-rf/, and someone is simply doing a reverse zone and piping it through more or awk or sed or something like this, that's going to break the query just as we do in SQL insertion and basically run an rm-rf on the machine, right? It's a bit hectic, but it's interesting. Like I said, legal disclaimer. You must decide if you want to play with this stuff or not. Right. I want to show you. I want to show you this. Okay. This is Qualys has these has this tool that can do a free kind of network map of your network, and they do it basically by using DNS, looking at your zones. So we had this big zone of lots and lots and lots of entries pointing everywhere across the internet in our zone, and we said, well, do a map of our network and see what you get. And as you can see, it's kind of not that clear where our network is located, because there's so many entries pointing everywhere on the internet. I think you get the idea, right? After a while, the tool basically gives up and says the discovery time has exceeded the limit. There's no real way to detect which IP addresses. If you're doing it automatically, there's no real way to detect which IP addresses are pointing to real IPs and which are pointing into the void. On a network level, what we can do is interesting, right? Avoiding, we all know what we do to avoid our machines being port scanned. We put a firewall in there, right? Our machines are still port scanned, but the scanner is not reporting all the ports that it can see. So that's like the wall, right? The firewall is in there. If we do noise, if we want to create noise in the system, we've got lots of interesting technologies that we can use, such as HoneyD, and what I actually used was transparent reverse proxies. Okay, so a transparent reverse proxy is basically something that says a connection that you get on this IP address, even if the IP address isn't bound to any interface, take that and pipe it into a process that's running on this box, right? Normally we use that for transparent proxies to go out, okay, transparently go out. In this case, we just use it in reverse, so it's a transparent reverse proxy. I'm going to show you how that works. And with this, what we can do is we can make random IPs alive. On those IPs that we have alive, we can have any ports open on those IPs, right? The other thing that we can do that is very interesting, and I haven't seen anyone do this before, is we can basically do trace route interception and misdirection. So how does this work? When you trace route to me, basically what happens is every hop along the way, when the TTL expires of that particular packet, right, we send back ICMP TTL expired. And the source of that ICMP TTL expired is shown in your trace route as a hop, correct? Now when we detect the trace route coming into our network, we can basically spoof any address and use that source address to reply with the ICMP TTL expired, correct? And whoever is doing the trace at the other side would report that IP as the next hop, which means we can move the network around as we wish. Okay, the endpoint stays the same, but the hops along the way can be anywhere. I'm going to show you how that works. We can also do fake network broadcast addresses by simply responding with more than one ICMP packet. Our scanners now think that there's a broadcast in that network. And some people, like ourselves, use broadcast addresses to find out where boundaries of networks are sitting. So all of a sudden, the network has very weird boundaries. All of this, we build this into a cron. We build it into a script that we put into cron that runs every 5 minutes, and every 5 minutes, all of this changes around, right? Okay. So machines that are up, ports that are up, the hops that we have change around, so that someone looking at it only has a 5 minute window to look at that particular configuration, which means nothing, right? Stopping a port scan, I think that's difficult to do, right? To actually really stop the port scan from completing. So if you have any ideas on that, pretty interesting. Killing a scanner, now we're talking about the scanner actually breaking, right? If we're killing a scanner, there's a couple of things that we can play with. It's not a lot, but there could be some vectors of attack. NMAP has a minus SV nowadays that actually displays the banner as well. So it could be that if we can put something in that banner or in that service that causes Nmap to break, that would be the point where I attack it. Also, we haven't found anything. We actually didn't look, but I'm sure it's possible to look at interesting stuff there. And even other scanners that deal with DNS. So when they do a forward lookup or they do a reverse lookup on the IP address that we're scanning, then we could possibly inject some interesting stuff into the reverse DNS entry, see what we can do. So I want to show you what we've done on a network level. We wanted to show all of this live, but it's the stuff is meant to break our stuff, so it's a little bit risky to start demoing in real time. So we only have the slides up. Alright, sorry, in terms of tools that we can use, that we can especially, kind of focus on to attack Nmap, Paketo, Pulse, Superscan, Visual Routes, Custom Scripts, anything that basically use Nmap could be interesting, especially when they start parsing the output of Nmap. We'll look into that some more later on. So basically, we've built this trace route interception misdirection thing and put it on our firewall so that when we trace out, this is the routes that that is going to show on its way to Google, right? And you can see we can hop these packets from Russia to Bulgaria to Uruguay to Nigeria to Australia to South Africa, Philippines, China, Mongolia, Kazakhstan, anywhere we want to go, which is a little bit confusing, I guess, to someone doing a trace route to your network, right? Can you see? Is it clear there from the back where the lines go? Okay, I hope so. And the other thing that we can do here, of course, is the IP addresses that we put in there, we can make them IP addresses, again, that you really don't want to attack, as in this case. So you have the Russian Information Agency, which is not someone you want to attack. The Bulgarian government network, you got the South African government, the Department of Science and Technology in the Philippines, and these kind of people, you don't want to look at those IP addresses because you never know who's going to visit your house. In terms of building stuff with the transparent reverse proxies, We've built a pull script that basically you set up on your firewall, and you can say, I want 7 web servers, 3 FTP servers, and 20 generic ports spread across 12 IPs with 5 broadcasts. And this is totally randomly generated. Okay, now, every time we run the script, we have that configuration somewhere in the network. We can say exclude the following IP addresses, which would be IP addresses that you would be using, right, from outside your mail server, that kind of thing, that you don't want to put into this list. And that then ends up with a whole lot of IPFW rules on FreeBSD. It's as simple as that, with, simple listeners at the back, so that everything is now sent, it says, from that particular machine, that port, send it into localhost on a specific listener. That listener is doing various things. We're going to look at that in a bit. Let's see what happens when you actually now start to use Nmap against a network like this. Okay. Right. I don't know if you can see at the back. You can't see at the back? Okay. And the focus is also kind of horribly wrong. Alright, I'm going to read it to you. It starts like this. Nmap minus SP, right, for reports. I'm not going to read the whole thing. it's basically Nmap minus SP, which is a ping scan. And here you can see that there's, a couple of machines that are alive on the network. Those machines are totally fake. And we get a whole lot of subnet broadcast addresses that pop up there as well, which pops up at ridiculous IP addresses, which can never be a subnet broadcast. So we're just confusing, we're adding noise into the system, right? Alright. So let's move on to the next level. The next level is on a network application level, right? So this is where your typical scanners are operating at the moment. stuff like Nessus, your vulnerability scanners are operating on this level. So avoiding getting a bad report, we all know you have to patch your system and you need to keep your system up to date, so that's really straightforward. When we put noise, if we want to inject noise into the system, we can create, a lot of stuff can be done with banners, right? So we put up a whole lot of fake banners, and we can combine this now with our listeners in our previous step, right? And we use a thing that I use, combined banners. Now, a combined banner is basically a banner that reports itself as several different versions of a particular daemon, right? When you start looking at how Scanner looks at that banner, and I actually only looked at how Nessus looks at it, you get several different plugins that looks at the banner, correct? Now, if you have, let's say, 30 tests for FTP, bad FTP servers, then you would find that around about 50% of them don't look where the particular string that they want to trigger on is located within the banner. Some of them say this string, the string has to start with this particular sequence, right? String sequence. But a lot of them don't. And if you don't, it means you're vulnerable to this kind of attack. It would mean your plugin would trigger, right, if you see a combined banner. I want to show you what a combined banner looks like. The other thing that we looked at was basically a nazzle reverse interpreter, a reverse nazzle. Okay, we know what nazzle is, right? Nazzle is the Nessus attack scripting language, which is basically where what plugins are written in. So if we can do the reverse of what a nazzle does, a nazzle basically says, send this data and wait until you get this response. If you get this response, then trigger and say it's a vulnerability. We can invert that says, if you get this request, respond in such a way, right? For our listeners, which means that we would trigger every plugin in the book, because we're really responding to the scanner as it would want us to respond for a positive. You understand what I'm saying? This is actually not as easy to build, but I think with people that are actually programmers. Because we're not really programmers, you can probably build something like that, you know, over lunch. In terms of stopping a vulnerability scanner, we can't really stop it. But what we can do is we can cause every plugin to timeout, right? Basically, we put a target or something in there that says, when you start speaking to me and we have a connection, then I'm simply not going to speak back to you. And you have to wait until that connection times out, which makes the scanner go really, really, really slow. Okay? In terms of killing it, this is actually, this is an interesting part of this. We can look at how the scanner actually handles the data that we're sending back. And now we can start looking at buffer overflows in scanners itself, especially if it's open source. We can start looking at if we can cause a buffer overflow in the scanner itself. But we can attack it on different levels. We can also look at where it renders the data, right? So when you have a scanner that displays stuff in HTML, for instance, right? When we render that HTML, we need to be sure that the stuff that we're getting back, for instance, in a banner, doesn't contain malicious HTML. So the easiest thing to do is basically to put a HTTP redirect inside of a banner, of let's say FTP banner or a SMTP banner, so that data is read. Okay, the HTML is now actually taken into the database, right? And when we display the results in HTML, we also display a meta tag that basically does a HTTP redirect, which means that if someone views the report, they get redirected to a different page. That page could then be a collection of malicious HTML. We tried this in the Windows version of Nessus, the Nessus WX. But they actually thought about this as well, so they fixed it up there. What's interesting is where a scanner is using another scanner, right? So you have a lot of scanners out there that the underlying principle, they're using a scanner like Nessus, or they're using a scanner like Nmap, right? And so if you can attack, you don't even have to attack the original scanner. You can attack where that data is actually rendered in the in the second tier scanner. And then of course we can attack it where it's inserted into databases, right? So a lot of the scanners out there have a MySQL database or a Microsoft SQL database at the back, and we can try to basically attack it where that data is populated. Okay, so if we have something that says single quote drop this these tables, and that stuff is not nicely validated before it goes into the database, as soon as that is written into the database, it's going to drop the entire database. Correct. And as we explained in our training, you can do all sorts of interesting things and do command execution going. So all of a sudden, the thinking is that SQL injection that people do, that the bad guys do on your network, you can now try to do on their scanners, right? If you do it clever. Right, so let's look at a couple of examples on how this can work. Okay, these are some of the tools that we can start looking at. Okay, so, and I've tried to enlarge this a little bit for the people at the back. So basically, we have a FTP server running on one of the machines. It's not a server at all. It's basically one of our listeners that we had in our previous section. And when you connect to it, it basically sends you, if you're connecting from an extern, it sends you stuff that appears in the title bar that says messing with sense post you are, owned you will become. We're going to use this later on again. So it's real easy to basically insert those characters, which is control characters for externs, and that will put that stuff on the title bar. We also can try various other things, like you can see I've got there O1=1--. We didn't want to put some bad stuff in there just yet, because we don't know who's scanning our network and we don't know what might be the legal implications of dropping their databases. But I see we've done a RM-RF there. Oh, on temp. Yes, on /temp, right? So you never know where this stuff ends up. And when we display this, or if we cat it, on a Unix machine, and we start manipulating the banners, that might have some effect. The second thing that we've done is we looked at Metasploit, right? Now we found that when you have when you get a shell on a machine, what's the first thing that you do? What's the very first character that you type? Normally, if someone gets a shell on a machine, they press enter, right, to see that the shell is really there. It just happens like that. You get a shell, you go enter, okay? Right? Okay. So basically what we've done here is we said we can have a listener, okay, that listens on a let's say a particular port. And what happens is that listener will send a we'll insert something in the reply that's going to go into our title bar, right? As we've seen with the previous FTP. From there, we can copy that from the title bar onto the command line, right? So basically, you're in a situation where if this works and someone is attacking you, you get a shell, what appears to be a shell, okay, with what appears to be a shell, copy something into the title bar. From there, we copy it into the command line. And what's the first thing you do when you get the shell? You press enter, right? Basically, executing that command, right? So in this case, we've shown it to you in visible mode so that you can see what's happening. So the command that we want to execute on our victim is ls-la, okay? So as soon as someone runs the command line Metasploit interface, he connects to our machine, he gets his shell. This is obviously not really a shell, it's just us pretending to be a shell, right? And these characters here is basically copying the stuff from the title bar onto the command line. The user presses enter and is executing a ls-la. Okay? If we do it in invisible mode, it looks even better. Okay? In invisible mode, you can't see what it is executing, right? What you must look at is where the cursor is sitting. Okay, the cursor, in this case, is sitting there at the back. That's the end of our ls-la that we run in invisible mode. So the user never sees what we're doing on his box. Obviously, where's the problem with this? The problem is sitting in your xterm. It's not sitting in Metasploit, correct? Okay, so let's go on to the last section, or the almost the last section. Let's look what we can do on application level. Okay. On application level, and especially when dealing with web servers. So to avoid web application scanners scanning your network, I guess you must get an application level firewall. Now, application level firewalls are not that common, but it's starting to get there, and people are starting to build these things and use them. And I guess, you know, we're going to go there real quick. To create noise, I just want to see, who was in Samuel Shah's talk on PHP God? Anyone? Okay. You can know, if you listen to Samuel's talk, you can know how you can create noise, right? When looking at web applications, right? I'm going to repeat a few of that things if you weren't in his talk. We can basically send random 404, 500, 302s, 200 replies, any kind of reply that we want to send back, we can reply with that, right? But we don't want to be sending too many of those replies so that the scanner, such as Nikto, can trigger on that and says, well, you're doing friendly 404s, okay? Your 404 messages are not real 404s because everything returns as a 200, okay? Correct. We don't want to send too many of those. We want to send maybe 10% of the stuff that we're sending back. We want to send as a positive. The rest we're just going to ignore. Then we have something in here that I want to quickly talk about, which is your Nessus 404, no 404 plugin. Okay, Nessus tests to find out if you are not replying in a nice way by sending something to your web server that says Nessus test dot and a few extensions, right? And the idea is that we can find out if our that the site that we are attacking is not replying with normal 404 messages. Now, if we know that Nessus is testing it like this, we can make intelligent choices about what we send back. So when Nessus asks for a Nessus test, we reply with a very nice 404 message. However, if it's asking for anything else, we reply with the 200. Okay. Within the application itself, we can have bogus forms, we can put fields in there, we can have pages that simply reply as if ODBC error connect, if an ODBC error occurred, and that's basically going to fool our application in a way that our scanner thinks it's found a problem. If you want, Samuel actually did a really good job of looking into this stuff in detail, so I suggest you read his paper. I don't know if it's in the book. I haven't seen it there. In terms of stopping stuff, we can look at what we call spider traps. Okay, I'm going to show you what a spider trap looks like just now. We can have detectors that detect browsers or humans, right? So that if you run an exploit against that, that's neither a browser or a human, and so it won't go through. In terms of killing, as soon as we find out that someone is trying to scan us, right? For instance, Samuel mentioned clear pixels that he puts on the screen, right? So it's a pixel that is totally transparent. A user will never click on that, but a program will click on it, right? As soon as someone clicks on that particular link, we can start spewing back malicious HTML to that application and see if we can break it. As soon as we find out that it's a browser connecting to us on a port where there is no web server, we can start sending malicious code to the browser. And I'm going to show you one of those as well. And you can even go on an application level a little bit deeper and say, we want to create a directory on our machine called /admin, right? And in /admin, we're going to put an exe called admin tool.exe. Now, a normal user shouldn't ever go in there and actually download that file, right? A normal user wouldn't see that directory. We never link to that directory. So a normal user wouldn't see it. But someone that's poking around in your system, they're going to find that file. They're going to see it's called admintool.exe. They're probably going to find it very interesting. Download it, run it, and it will kill their machine, right? So let's just look at some examples of this. Okay, these are the tools that we can attack. There's a couple of them. Okay, so this is the output of a Nessus scan with only the CGI family of plugins enabled, and you will see that it returns just about every error that you can find on HTTP, right? Normally, if you don't have this, Nessus will have small little entry in there that says it appears that your site is not replying with correct 404s. Though if we run it, if the user now goes to any of these vulnerabilities with the browser to see if the vulnerability actually occurs, we can pass him this page, right? And I don't know who's seen that page before. If you try to close that browser, you got four more browsers that hops around the screen like this. Okay? And if you try to close those, you have four more for each of those four, until the box kind of grinds to a halt. Remember again, this we can make on a trigger for a specific file type for a specific location. It's really easy to make it so that a normal user is never going to see that. And we're not going to run it on our web server. We're going to run it on some of our fake web servers that we have out there. So in terms of seeing this, you have to see this in combination with the previous network level stuff that says these machines are open. These ports are open on these machines, right? Randomly moving them across. On the left-hand side, what you see is what we call a spider trap. Okay, so we have this transparent, well, in our case, it's not transparent. It's just a pixel somewhere on our front page of our website. If you click on that pixel, it's going to give you a page full of random links, okay, which is basically generated by a pull script. If you click on any of these, you get another page like this. Okay, so it never stops. You get pages on pages on pages of stuff coming back to you. And a spider can never get out of this. Okay, so if you use something like wget for sure, HTTrack, that's the one I'm looking for. Use HTTrack against that site, you will find that it just simply never ends. It keeps on going forever. Of course, all of this stuff you want to be, you want to make certain that you, you want to make certain that you run these things not on all incoming IPs. So you would have an exclude list so that when Google actually tries to mirror your site, this stuff is not displayed, right? It's redirected to the front page to make sure that you're not killing your mirroring tools that's supposed to mirror your site. Okay, so the last thing I want to talk about is an interesting. We have till 11, or do we have till quarter to 11? To 11 o'clock, right? Okay, cool. Okay, excellent. The last thing I want to talk to you about is a kind of a technology. It's not a technology. It's actually just a way of thinking that we developed called armpits, right? Which is, we thought about a tar pit, and then we thought, well, we need something that's really not nice and smelly, so we called it an armpit. Okay. Okay, and to understand where the armpit stuff happens, I want to tell you the story how we got to it. On our site, we initially have this flash intro, right? You see this flash intro that's too long. It's about 3 minutes long or something like this. That you look at the flash intro, and then you basically from there are redirected into our main site. Okay? But there's a little link at the bottom that says skip intro, which everybody clicks on, I'm sure, right? So initially when I played with this stuff, I said, well, what's going to happen if I take the skip intro link away? Okay, so now there's no way of getting into the site unless you a deep link, right? So you have a URL where you you know, you have a specific page that you're going to, or if you let the demo continue and you let the demo run through its whole 3 minutes, and then afterwards it's going to send you into the site, right? And that's cool. So I tried it. I took the link off that says skip the demo, and I use a mirroring tool to see if I can mirror. I took the little pixel, I took that out, and I saw if I can mirror the site. Now there's nothing on the front page that links into the site at all. So in order to get to the rest of the site, you need to understand Flash. You need to be able to understand how Flash works. You need to interpret it, right? Then what I've done is I've taken the Flash demo, and where it was now 3 minutes, I made it 0 minutes and 0 seconds, which is now basically just a redirect. Okay? So if you click on it, if you open it up in a browser, it immediately redirects you to the main site. And then I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. And so we built this thing. I'm going to show you how it works. It's called Armpit. Okay, it's sitting on a network level. Okay, it's sitting on a session level, and it acts as a proxy. Okay, so you don't need to change anything on your original content. It acts as a proxy. Typically on your firewall you would run this. It doesn't add a lot of overhead. There's not a lot of things that we need to do within here. I'm going to show you how easy it works. And it creates Flash. It uses Flash to create a kind of a session ID, okay, which is now a request, basically just a request that we're sending to the website. And because we operate on network level, we can intercept that request and see exactly what's in there. Okay. When we get a request that is valid, we send back a cookie to the browser, right? And if the cookie, if we now get a request with a cookie in there and that cookie is valid, we basically relay the connection through. So let's look what it looks like, okay? We get an incoming connection. The first thing we do, we say, is there a valid cookie in this connection? If there's not a valid cookie in the connection, we say, is the request string that we're sending, remember we can intercept anything, right? Is the request that we're sending, is that valid? If it's not valid, it means it's the first time that the user has gone to the site, okay? What we do then is we build a Flash page, dynamically build a Flash page, because it's not that difficult, right? We send that back to the browser. The browser now interprets the Flash, correct? Okay? And the Flash page redirects him into us again with the valid request string. Okay, so he doesn't have a cookie at this stage. So he goes into that little decision tree again, going the no route for a valid cookie. But at this stage, he's got a valid request string, right? His request string is valid. When I say valid, I mean it matches some kind of checksum. It adheres to some kind of checksum. It doesn't matter what kind of checksum. We could put any kind of checksum in there, right? If it is a valid request string, it now builds that. It takes that request, the actual checksum, puts it in a cookie, and sends the cookie back to the browser. Okay, and that cookie never expires. So now we have a cookie that's valid, right? So when we now make the connection again, we have a valid cookie, and we can now relay the connection. Okay, it sounds a bit dodgy, right? So I'm going to show you what it looks like in the at-stake web proxy, right? The first request that you see is just made to the site, right? At that stage, it's sending you back a Flash page. The Flash page would redirect you into the site again and build the request string that contains a checksum. In this case, we made it real simple. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and a couple of nines. 5 minutes. That's cool. Okay. And then after that, when the browser requests it again, it gets a cookie. Now you can see there, at the cookie we made it not a very strong cookie. We just says poof equals way secret. Okay. That could be our normal. The way secret part would typically be our checksum. And so it goes through this loop, and the bottom line of this, what it means is that if we don't interpret flesh, if we can't understand flesh, right, we can't get to the site at all. So typically, a worm that someone writes, or an odor exploit, or something like this, wouldn't be coded to understand flesh. It's not going to be have a flesh interpreter in there to be able to find out where it's going to redirect to, okay, and get the actual checksum. It's going to help a lot. And for the user, it's totally transparent. User doesn't see anything. User just searches. Once he has the cookie, you know, he can simply walk through the application as per normal. We can, of course, build it like this so that the connections are only allowed to our web server from our human or browser detector. Or we can do it with the firewall, right? Firewall that we say we have the human detector running on port 80 and our web server running on port 81. We're basically just relaying between the two, and we're only allowing port 80 to go through. If we combine this with the IPS, it starts to become powerful. Because now all of a sudden what we do is we have a bad cookie jar, right? And if we detect that someone is doing something bad, we blacklist the cookie. We don't keep track of the cookies, the valid cookies, we keep track of the invalid cookies. Okay? So you've got an incoming connection. If you have a valid cookie, if you've gone through the whole process, we check if this is an evil request based upon our IPS. If it is an evil request, we basically blacklist the cookie and send the guy back. Now that cookie isn't valid anymore, okay? And he's got to go through the process again. Okay, so there you can see, we built this thing simply to look for XP command shell. And if we put in the XP command shell, just like a normal IPS, we say, you are naughty, we will blacklist your cookie. And now that cookie itself is blacklisted and it doesn't mean anything anymore. It's destroyed, right? The session is destroyed. Okay, last thing I want to run through very quickly is content level. If you think someone is, let's say, sniffing your network, you can put some bait in there for that. If someone is reading your mail, you can put some bait in there by saying, okay, I would mail Harun and tell him, Harun, the secret document is at this website, right? And then I simply monitor that website to see who hits it, right? And I know that my traffic is being read, or my stuff has been read. It doesn't matter where it's coming from, the fact it is being read. The last thing I want to talk about is traffic that bites back. If you have, for instance, stuff that will break the sniffer itself. So you're transmitting stuff across the wire that's going to break the sniffer at the other end. I don't think we have to go into that a lot. What's the bottom line? The bottom line is you should worry when administrators are thinking, starts to think like hackers, right? We always think our administrators are quite docile and they don't care too much, right? But when they start thinking the way that you think, we're going to have a total different ballgame, right? And it's going to cause lots of paranoia on the side of the attackers. I don't think it really makes your network safer, right? It doesn't make your network safer, but it makes the cost of doing an assessment against that much more. I thank you very much.